The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. The New York State Harm Reduction Association held its annual conference October 21st and 22nd. On today's show, we're going to hear some highlights. First, from day one of the conference, here's Tracy Gardner, co-director of the National Black Harm Reduction Network.
I've worked with a lot of people also on the criminal justice side. That's a whole other discussion. But we know Eddie Ellis was this guru who talked about justice reform. And he said we needed something like a Marshall Plan. He called it the Thurgood Marshall Plan. But it's about reconstruction. And it's about reconstruction to address the damage of the war on drugs, which wasn't just the war on people who use drugs. It took money out of communities. It took resources out of communities. And it never put it back. It never put it back where it needed to be. It never put it back into the schools. It never put it back into the parks. It never put it back into the healthcare system. It put it back into law enforcement, right? Investments. We have to demand funding for investments instead of emergency response. And I told, we were talking yesterday, I've been obsessed with this idea that we keep lurching from one public health emergency to the next. And over the last 50 years, that's all we've done. And we have built nothing to prepare ourselves for the next, right? The early heroin, HIV, crack, COVID, MDR-TB, remember that? Multidrug-resistant TB? And now this overdose epidemic that I think Sheila talked about in terms of the waves, right? But this, the person who talked about emergency management and the fact that we keep responding to emergencies, a guy named Eric Cadora, who did a study about the million-dollar blocks, that we put so much public dollars into places, into like basically four square blocks, $1 million. And what do we get for it? Continued illness, continued health disparity, continued lack of investment because we're responding to the emergency. As we see epidemics come down, medical solutions flow up. This was a TED talk by a journalist who's been tracking COVID, but this could be said for any of the health emergencies that we've gone through, that the benefits come down very slowly and are not mindful of our suffering and our death. So I want to talk about HIV/AIDS in 1996 when, quote unquote, people stopped dying. There was every international AIDS conference, people were always looking for the thing that would stop the ravage of HIV and AIDS. And at the 11th conference, we discovered protease inhibitors. And the Ryan White Act, do people know that? Big comprehensive federal law and money to address the multi-system impact of HIV. In 1996, AIDS stopped being the leading cause of death for all Americans, 25 to 44. But it was still the leading cause of death for African Americans. That's 1996. I had a baby in 1996. He is 28. And so the urgency and who's been impacted is important to look at. And that many of us have lived through two Cuomos, a couple of presidents, and where we are with the overdose epidemic and that we built during HIV, the connection's not happening, y'all. We're reinventing the wheel and people are dying while we do it. I worked at Gay Men's Health Crisis in 1993, and this was the early face of AIDS. These folks was relentless. The moms of these white gay men were taking no risk. They were going for it. They went to Congress, they went to the legislature, they went everywhere, and they raised money because their sons had to experience the public health network that was okay for black and brown folks. Because we're the canary in the coal mine. If we get sick, it's coming for you. That's just as American as pie. And of course, Sheila talked about the waves. We didn't start caring until fentanyl hit the islands, Staten and Long. But it was killing our old heads, our beloved old men, older men in the Bronx, well before. They were the canary in the coal mine. And I can say that no one cared. Why can I say that no one cared? Because I was working in the governor's office at the time. They were not concerned about the sudden overdose deaths in the Bronx in 2015. They didn't care. There wasn't a constituency. There we go, where fentanyl showed up. 2018, supposedly, but it was there in 2015 and before. This is the new face of addiction. This is the new face that people want to see. This is a new face that people care about. This is the kinder and gentler, right? The fentanyl contaminated pills. I'm working with a mom who lost her 43-year-old son. She lives in the Bronx, community board 5 in the Bronx. That's also where a toddler was killed after exposure to fentanyl, because the daycare worker, the husband of the daycare worker, was manufacturing and, you know, doing his trap business in the same place as the nursery school. That's hideous. That's hateful. But the attitude now that is in the community since that death is to blame the drug users, to blame the economy of drug use, and not look more comprehensively at what we're talking. So this baby died, and they literally have said, we can only talk about overdose behind closed doors. They just sentenced the guy to 45 years, as if he's not going to be punished himself. This is a man who had a brother who died of overdose. So I'm going to skip through this. American drug policy has always been about race, and that's why we have a treatment system, and that's why we have mean drug court judges, and that's why. And it's not a DEI thing. It's just a reality. Just understand how much historical institutional racism is so infused, it continues to inform the inequities that happen for all of us. So if we don't recognize the inequities as something beyond just dealing with Black people, dealing with Native Americans, then we're all on schedule to be sick and die. Remember this? A different way that we treat opioid use versus crack. The overdose epidemic hit a system that was built for crack, plain and simple. It was refined to address crack. It was refined to address the people who use crack and the systems that connected with them: housing, criminal justice, incarceration, child protective services. And again, also the healthcare system, all to punish. And this is where it's got us. The new Jim Crow helped America understand why there were so many Black and brown bodies in our prison systems. And it seemed to coincide with the emergence of overdose. But our history is such that some people are privileged to use, some people can't. I was getting sodium barbitol. Woo! Mommy's little helper. Menopause, child. Oh, the transition without tears. Pharmaceuticals to the rescue. And yet, here we are in 2024, just now willing to acknowledge that alcohol's been killing people and killing their systems all along. Who's going to sue the alcohol industry? Where's that settlement? It's got to come. So you can read this later, but I'm going to close with talking about some of the differences, because I was on the New York State AIDS Advisory Council. And this is an entity, public health law, advising the health department during the height of the HIV epidemic and as it continued. It was probably also the place where Charles and folks came up with the idea of the End the Epidemic and got a document and a statement of endorsement from Governor Andrew Cuomo, and one of the recommendations was overdose prevention centers. But they'll continue to ignore it because it's not politically savory, right? So the AIDS Advisory Council did a lot of reports, but what it also did was it created a space for people to look at the latest data, get information from communities who were being impacted, and make some recommendations to government, because government generally doesn't know what to do. They need us to guide them and tell them what to do. And then there's the Opioid Settlement Board. I'm sorry, OSFAB. It's got its third report coming. Again, the money from year one still hasn't gone out. It gets letters from those of us who are professional advocates. It just puts them in the on the website for the settlement board. And what is bizarre to me, as I see my beloved Asia, is not even 20 years ago, when HIV funds came to city and state, governments couldn't put the money out unless they conferred with the community. HIV prevention planning, planning means you work together, you compile the data together, you plan based on what you know. I'm here to tell you that right now, that's not happening with this year more than $36 million of settlement money. There is, back then, the money would go out when there was what is called concurrence with the community and with government, and they had to agree or the money wasn't coming. What also happened is that the work was done. The recommendations were informed by work groups to then inform the larger body based on information that was gathered from people who were closest to the issue. Yeah. So, you know, I came into this because I lost my childhood friend to HIV in 1986. And I was like, this, to me, it was about the hypocrisy and discomfort that we had to talk about sex and drugs. And even then, the approach was abstinence only. It's very much in our core somehow, kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Don't be dependent on anything. You can be strong and just overcome. We don't have a system that asks why. We don't have a system that asks why. And I'm saying to you all in this room, we have to make these systems and these stakeholders and these officials ask why people use drugs and respond to it. We would have an entirely different system if we based it on the why of drug use.
That was Tracy Gardner, co-director of the National Black Harm Reduction Network, speaking on day one of the New York State Harm Reduction Association's annual conference. This is Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On today's show, we're featuring highlights from the New York State Harm Reduction Association's annual conference. One of the speakers on day two of the conference was Nabarin Dasgupta, PhD, MPH. Dr. Dasgupta is a street drug scientist, the co-founder of the Remedy Alliance for the People, an innovation fellow at the University of North Carolina Gillings School of Global Public Health, and a senior scientist at the UNC Injury Prevention Research Center.
AIDS Institute just published this paper, the kind of first ever description of the New York State community drug checking program. Y'all should check it out. The guys have been great partners. So we get the results back to the individual because inside the kit is a blue card with a QR code that people can use to get the results directly from the site. And so they don't have to go through anybody else. They don't have to create a password or log in. We don't have collect cookies on our website. We don't do any of this. It is completely anonymous who sees the results. So what happens when people get their results? Put aside what you know about drug checking for just a second. Our intent is to help people answer the questions that are meaningful to them. They don't have to tell us what they found out. So here's some specific questions that we have helped answer. A drug user union in Texas wanted to know if there was fentanyl in the black tar. I was like, maybe, who knows, right? Like, that could be a thing. And there was a debate within that union about whether there was fence. And so we worked with them to figure out how to systematically sample in five or six cities in different parts of the state. They sent us the samples. And guess what? They figured out that there were two trafficking routes, one that was land-based and one that was water-based, like through the Gulf. And fentanyl was contaminating one of those distribution channels, the black tar, and it wasn't in the other. So using this information, the union was able to inform their participant, or you know, their members about where and when to look out for fentanyl in the black tar if it was showing up unexpectedly. There was another drug user union in Nevada who had a street rumor going around that you could detect xylazine and fentanyl in the heroin by using a black light. And we were like chemistry nerds, right? So we were like, okay, drawing the molecule shape and trying to figure out like maybe this could energy activation, blah, blah, blah. But we couldn't figure it out. Like maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. The user union sent us pictures of like piles of dope fluorescing different colors under black light. And we're like, okay, those are different colors. They bagged and sent us the samples, but we didn't run black lights through them. So we analyzed and gave them the results without knowing, you know, like in a blinded or masked fashion, and as good scientists should do, and told them exactly what was in those substances. They called us and said, cool, thank you so much. This really helped solve. And now we know what the answer is. Goodbye. And we're like, what's the answer? So I don't know. I don't know if you can use black lights to detect fentanyl and xylazine in the drug supply in central Nevada, because that doesn't matter to me. Like that doesn't matter to my staff. The drug supply is going to change so fast anyways. It could be some additive thing. Like we as scientists need to get over retaining information. It is good enough. We are good enough to let people answer that question. And then we get the out the way. And that is totally fine. Totally fine. The other thing that one of the unexpected things that has happened with the drug checking is widows coming to us and asking, what killed my husband? He only smoked meth. Here's his pipe. Can you help me get closure? Because the autopsy results aren't going to be available for 8 months. And shout out to the North Carolina Medical Examiner's office, because they talk to those parents or the people left behind and give them like regular updates. Our medical examiner is awesome. But we were able to give these widows some closure. That wasn't in the protocol. We're at this point with drug checking in the United States right now. If we try to over-evaluate this intervention, if we try to put metrics around this, we're going to kill the innovation that happens when we give, when we liberate technology, when we liberate knowledge, and then step away and let our harm reduction folks do what they have always done. Let the people who use drugs be the innovators as they have always been, to take this technology and this new paradigm to a new level. Final example, a collective of sex workers on the North Carolina-Georgia border had a inkling that their clients were putting more sedating drugs into the drugs that they're being given. So they secretly and systematically sampled all their clients. We tested the drugs, told them what was in it, and they made a do not call back list. This all happened without us knowing that this was happening. This all happened because that was a community need. They figured out what they needed to do. We only found out about it months later, and we just analyzed the samples and told them objectively what we found was in the actual drug supply. So there's so much more we can do with drug checking than this idea that people need to test their drugs every single time. Claire Schmidt at the Remedy Alliance wrote this recently during an exercise we were doing. Drug checking doesn't solve the problem. It only gives us context for why people are dying. It's a little depressing, but let's also be real about the limits of this technology. This is what surprises me about our drug checking service. 70% of our samples are post-consumption. Right? This is not your festival setting where people can wait around to use their mushrooms tomorrow or whatever, right? 70% of our samples show that people have used it, their sensations or an overdose reported. What this tells me is that people are using our service. A, they're sending us samples preferentially because something weird happened. We also like ask for normal samples so we can benchmark, right? But what we're getting is like small clusters of citizen science. We routinely get reports of like, yo, this batch killed a bunch of people or put a bunch of people in the hospital. We got your results. You know what the feature on the website that was most requested was the print button. So that you can print out the result and people would literally bring it to their suppliers who would take that piece of paper up the chain and say, this batch contained this terrible thing in it that is causing this problem. And we hear of these batches being destroyed. Do you have another intervention where people voluntarily, in a science-based way, destroy tainted supply? No, we don't have another intervention like that. Those little things are saving lives. But if I was like a real researcher and tried to measure that, I would kill it. I'd kill the beautiful paradigm, this beautiful thing that's blossoming around drug checking. We believe in autonomy. We want to help people make better decisions about what they put in their bodies. This is Queen City Harm Reduction in Charlotte. So let's think about the drug supply in a little bit more detail. This is from international conference of people who use drugs when describing the drug supply. What fresh hell is this? I'm going to give you my handy Dr. Nabb's 4 ways to understand the drug supply, all right? I'm also starting to get hungry because I'm always hungry. So I'm going to use food as examples. Food is how I see, is my way of interacting with the world. The thing I want you to remember is that whatever happens in the drug supply is also happening in the consumer goods space. You can understand the drug supply by looking at legal psychoactive substances, nicotine, alcohol, chocolate, okay? Mm-hmm. You think chocolate's not psychoactive? Mm-hmm. Number one, counterfeits, fake pills, okay? So let's look at fish. There was sole. It said it was sole on the menu yesterday here, right? There was this study that was done where this group went and like bought fish from supermarkets and grocery stores and tried to see if what it was labeled as was actually what it was. Guess what? 50% of the time, if it's like a white flaky fish, a snapper or a sea bass, 50% of the time, that was not what it was, okay? Why do we expect anything different in the drug supply? We shouldn't. But look down here, lobster. I'm from Maine. I grew up in Maine. Lobster, how do you mislabel a lobster? Like fentanyl, lobster, these are obvious things in the drugs, right? In the food. Lobster ravioli, when things are repackaged, when things that are obvious are repackaged in new ways and put into new forms, they are unexpected. And this is what number one, counterfeits is one way to understand the drug supply. Number two, adulterants. Y'all like chocolate? I'm sorry to tell you about chocolate. That there is a ton of cadmium and lead in dark chocolate. I know, I'm ruining it for you, I'm sorry. Milk chocolate, better. All the organic ones that are labeled organic and stuff are worse. Ghirardelli is actually better for the contaminants and adulterants. The chaos that we see in the consumer goods space is already bad enough. Why would we expect an unregulated drug supply to be any different? Why are we surprised that drugs are so disturbingly contaminated? We heard about xylazine. This is from programs that are sending us drug samples. Okay, so looking specifically at North Carolina, we've had an increase in the amount of fentanyl samples testing positive for xylazine in New York. Y'all are coming down just a little bit, but this gives you a sense of the kind of very rapid data. These data go through the end of October. Into the middle of October, so we can generate these. But there is a huge difference in where we're seeing xylazine show up. Number three, potency. Potency fluctuations happen. And in North Carolina, going back to the days of prohibition, you could get these two. You can only buy one of these in the liquor store, and one of these you can buy at gas stations. Maybe it's similar here. But they look nearly identical, okay? One of these is 33% alcohol. The other is 6% alcohol. One is whiskey, one is malt liquor, okay? They look nearly identical. So when this happens in the drug supply, why are we surprised? When like regulated big products, this happens too. Polysubstance. Everything except for meth and crack is polysubstance. There is no such thing as like a fentanyl sample just by itself. This is three samples that are heroin that were sold as heroin in very close area in North Carolina. One had all this stuff. In high, you know, like within a month, it looked like that. Within a week, it looks completely different. So you have these completely different sets of things being called heroin and sold as heroin. Why are we surprised? And then you see fake pills that look like the contents of heroin or what was sold as heroin, but it's just fentanyl, okay? Here's another sample. We use the term messy brew. It's a very technical term, trademark it. This is from Asheboro in central North Carolina. This sample has 16 different things. There's medications. There is veterinary medications, numbing agents, procaine. Y'all got procaine in your supply in New York. This sample probably had some dope that came from this sample, right? As someone who checks drugs in New York knows, right? We see stimulants in here. We see things of organic origin. And we see melatonin. Why the hell are people putting melatonin in the drug supply? I don't know, but it happens. So we started doing drug checking because the Urban Survivors Union asked us to. Here's another example of humility. In the summer of 2020, the North Carolina Urban Survivors Union was saying, hey, we're seeing this huge increase in skin wounds. We did this study with a bunch of SSPs. And you'll notice we put the authors, I mean, the people who work at the SSPs as authors, and we paid them and we paid the participants cash to do this work with us, right? To do this survey of skin and soft tissue infections in North Carolina. We thought, okay, that's done. And then this is Don Jackson with FTIR in Greensboro. And he was the first in January 21 to identify xylazine and say, hey, this is what's linked to the skin wounds. And so we did this whole paper. We did this whole like published research without knowing it was xylazine that was causing this, because it was done during COVID when we were having people do stuff on like iPads, and we as researchers and the clinical folks couldn't go look at the wounds, and we couldn't get those descriptions of the wounds, and we didn't know to look. So here's what Louise predicted in January of 2021. Xylazine sure feels like an opioid. The withdrawal is different from fentanyl. Xylazine is causing these skin wounds. Men and women react differently, and the sleepiness returns after 45 minutes. We know this all now, right? It took us scientists 3 years to do the scientific experiments that proved that xylazine is a kappa opioid, that there is a sex difference, and all these other things that Louise predicted 3 years before. And we listened and we designed our experiments to follow the lead that a drug user union had told us to take. This is another Emily Payne study, thank you, that Sharon mentioned, where we're seeing more withdrawal. So here's like the really important thing to think about. If we're saving a life, can't they just endure the withdrawal? At a compassionate naloxone summit, Malcolm had this to say. After a really bad overdose reversal withdrawal event, he wanted to redose himself with heroin immediately, and he wanted to use alone for months afterwards. More severe withdrawal from naloxone leads people to have riskier behaviors down the line. When the pharmaceutical companies tell you, look, these withdrawal patterns are just a little bit higher, that translates to more risky behavior, more overdose chances, the higher the dose of naloxone. So we're at a point where we are starting to build the evidence base to push back against these corporate interests.
That was Dr. Navarun Dasgupta speaking on day two of the New York State Harm Reduction Association's annual conference. And for now, that's it. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy and the failed war on drugs.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.